Hi, guys. This is your host, Steve Mathis. Before we get started with this lovely edition of the BTOsports.com podcast show brought to you by Trans World Motocross, I just want to put out a shout-out, as they say, the cool kids say, to my own website, pulpmx.com, P-U-L-P-M-X.com. Check it out and, see what you think. As well, follow me on Twitter at pulpmx. So Twitter, pulpmx, website, pulpmx. All right, I'm done with the pimping. Now, onto the podcast show.
This is a warning. Your brain may explode from listening to this show. We will not be held responsible if it does. What are you going to do about it anyway? You won't have a head. You have been warned.
Welcome to the BTOsports.com podcast show, brought to you by Trans World Motocross, hosted by Steve Mathis.
Welcome to the BTOsports.com Trans World Motocross podcast. I'm your host, Steve Mathis, and I'm sure you guys know that. With me on the phone is none other than one of the coolest guys in the pits, one of the last guys to beat Ricky Carmichael, and now Grand Poobah, or at least very high up at Scott at Cherubies USA. I'm talking about none other than Talon Volin. Lone Wolf, what's up?
All right, Steve. Hey, I appreciate you calling me. Not too much, man. Just, now I work for Scott and the Cherubies, and I'm pretty busy in my office. My computer now is like my bike. So just doing a lot of emails and looking at this rain come down, getting ready to catch a flight, go down there and be part of the Supercross again this weekend.
Yeah, I know. It's going to be a mutter. I know. This show probably won't make it till after A2, but it's going to be a real test of goggles, for sure.
Yeah, that's right. That's why we have guys like Chad Reed and now Davey Millsaps and Austin Stroop wearing our products, and just continue, to help us develop our products for the average consumer.
Right.
So, just continue to be involved in racing like Scott has always has.
You know what was funny was, did you wear Scott when you rode all, I guess mostly you probably did, huh?
Yeah, I did mostly, through my career. There are sometimes, particularly when I was racing in Europe, where sometimes it's kind of like Mitch, where you sign with a team and you're obligated to wear the contracted team sponsor. So in those cases, unfortunately, I would have to change. But most of my career, I was a Scott rider.
Yeah, okay, all right. And I guess let's start off with this. First of all, as a retired racer, not too far out of the scene, you've landed on your feet pretty good. You've got a good job at Scott and at Cherubies. I guess you're fortunate, right, to stay in the industry. You must be thankful every day.
Yeah, I really like being in the industry. As me and you were talking before we got on here, quickly people forget, but it's still nice, and I still see a lot of fans that are older fans, 30s and 40s that were in the 90s. They go, oh, man, Town, you're my favorite rider, So that's still a good thing for me. I like to feel that. It makes me feel good. Nowadays you don't hear that with the young riders too much, but, I still get a lot of fans that remember me, particularly like when I went to the D-Nation, especially in Europe, because I spent a lot of my career there.
A lot of the former racers, though, let's face it, not a lot of you guys have education, and sometimes when the cheering stops, guys struggle with that a little bit. But, like I said, you've got yourself a pretty good deal going with Scott, it's good to know that, the industry takes care of its old racers, I guess.
Yeah, I lived a long time in Europe, and I learned a lot over there, and I learned to speak Italian, and that's how I initially started, is getting a deal with Franco at Cherubies, and so that made sense with Italian connection and everything, mm-hmm. and then moving right over to Scott. I try to use those things, and I try to now just let my investments that I made racing work for me and just try to work and live off the money that I make with the companies. Every year it increases, so guys obviously are making more money every year.
Yeah.
But I'm not rich, but I did okay, and I'm happy to have a job and work in the industry.
Yeah, so you weren't, at the end of the pro circuit days, you weren't penniless, let's say. You've made some smart moves?
No. Actually, it was as things, it's so strange. Life is stranger than dreams. Going to Europe in the early 90s, thinking that my career was pretty much over, and 10 years later come back and have basically a factory ride with a FMF on the team and then pro circuit. It was just like a dream. You couldn't have dreamed that.
Your salaries at FMF Honda and PC were probably more than you ever made in Europe, though, right? Or
You know what's weird is, yes, they were actually financially, but by not incorporating, I ended up paying more in taxes. So in Europe, you're able to bring up to $70,000 tax-free. So in the end, it was pretty close.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, it was still great. The bonuses were great over here in America.
Yeah,
unfortunately,
yeah.
This economy is killing everybody right now.
Yeah, and so a couple years ago, more than that, I'm sure, but a Cherubis bought Scott. Is that how it happened? What happened with the merger? I never really...
No, let me explain real fast. Quickly, in 2004, Cherubis went under Scott. So Franco wanted to sell the building here. They went under Scott. Scott was now the importer and then worked with our distributors. So they weren't really running it. They didn't buy it. They were just running it for Franco Cherubis. And 2 years ago now, they are, the beginning of 2009, Cherubis is a complete separate company. I've been fortunate enough to be able to, they're both friendly companies. They let me work with both, which helps me out income-wise and everything. But they're two separate companies now.
Oh, okay.
Nothing together.
I guess I don't know where I got that from. We'll scratch that.
Well, they were together.
Yeah.
They were together, but a lot of people don't really know. And we do definitely want that clear between both companies that they are separate.
Yeah, yeah. Let's get this clear, too. Scott is blowing up right now. They are, you know, you had the Genius Boot launch a few years back. You have a complete line of gear. Tommy Hahn won a national in it last year. This year you have Millsaps and Stroop. You have a helmet out that Stroop's wearing. I mean, Scott is really making a push, huh?
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's amazing that Biot, who's the owner of our company, he's been really aggressive, and, you know, he's putting the money on the table when a lot of people are pulling back. And, you know, hopefully it pays off in the end. I think that it will. You know, like they say, you know, you buy when people are running and run when people are bullish, you know. So he's been aggressive, and, you know, I think we've got to be near to the bottom in our industry.
Yeah.
I feel like we're a bit on a roller coaster, you know, and ours is the motorcycle industry is the last roller coaster. So we're still heading a little bit down, getting ready to make that upswing, but I feel like general economy is coming up, so it could be a good time to make that bet.
Yeah. The gear is nice. I like the gear. It looks good. It's been in Europe for years, right, before it came to America?
Yeah, for a few years it has, and it does look really nice. I'm pretty impressed with it. You know, Austin's done a great job for us out there, as well as Davey. But I will tell you, I have seen the designs for next year, and they're amazing. Bob Maynard's doing a great job with Scott right now.
Yeah, Stroop's been getting some serious TV time with his starts and the way he's been running up front. No doubt about it.
Yeah. I wish I could have took a starting lesson from that kid. Even in Christmas. I mean, I saw a photo the other day online that he was out a whole bike length ahead of the whole pack. I don't know what he's doing there, but hopefully he'll keep doing it.
It's the Scott helmet, boots, and goggles. It's just a package.
That's it.
Hey, how's the Genius Boot doing? You don't see it on, you know, Ferry wear it for a little bit. You see it, you don't see a whole ton of them in the pits. How's that going? How's that market happening? And what's going on with
it? The boot market's a tough market to enter, and we've been in it about 2 years now, and there's been a few setbacks on the boot, but we've readjusted, retooling, and they're making it better and better. They're evolving it, and so they took a little step back with sponsorship to make sure everything's 100% before we move forward. So everything is good with Scott and the Scott boots, as well as the new helmets coming up.
Yeah, when's the helmet coming out? I haven't seen it, or have I just missed the ads, or...?
It's actually coming out, I don't even know if I can say this, but I think officially after Indy, I don't know if I can say that, but they're pretty much ready. You know, this thing's getting ready to come out. We have Austin wearing it, so it should be within the next month or two. It'll be out.
Well, I feel like the boots get a little bit of a bad rap. I have a pair, and they definitely are different than anything else, but once you get used to them, they feel fine. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just they feel a little weird at first, but if you spend an hour or two, all of a sudden, the A-Star boot or the Garnet boot feels weird. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah, no, that's true. It's just something you got to get used to. You know, it's a point of where, you know, we're going for more protection. So if you're more protection-orientated, this boot is that direction. If you're more for feel, you do sacrifice a little bit of feel for protection. So that's just the difference, you know?
Yeah, my buddy has ankle problems and won't ride with anything else. Loves the Scott boot, like, just refuses to ride with anything else. So
great.
So he's got a jacked up ankle, and the thing just hugs his ankle, and he just loves it. So anyways, So for you, basically, you touched a little bit on the economy. What has that affected salaries for riders to wear the goggles and the gear and all that? I mean, has it come down majorly since, say, 2-3 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's probably down about 60%.
Wow.
Which is substantial when you're talking the size amount of numbers that these guys were used to get.
What's a top guy's salary for? You don't need to name any. What are they making in the range to wear goggles? Anybody's goggles, you know. give me a range.
I hear different numbers, and it depends if you talk to their managers. Sometimes the managers, you know. It's kind of difficult because sometimes you're like trying to do a deal, and it goes, sorry, we're going to go the other way, and we got $200,000, which is a ridiculous amount. That doesn't happen out there,
right.
But. I actually literally have had managers say that, more than that.
Wow.
That's what they signed for, but I know it's not true. I mean, it could be anywhere from, you have guys going from 10 to 40
to
50 even.
Yeah,
That's about really the range.
Yeah, yeah, 50 grand for a top guy to wear a goggle. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
It's crazy, but at least, so now are you saying now that that's 60% less from what it was? And the guys in the 10 grand range are now making 4?
The guys in a 10 grand range are making, they're getting product. And, it's dropped. I mean, obviously I don't want to talk about numbers. I don't want to be careful with the company and everything,
right.
but they are substantially, less.
And also for the fact you probably don't want to talk about numbers because when you're ready to sign somebody, you think about yourself back in the day winning 125 Supercrosses and you probably want to gouge your eyes out.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, let's talk about your career a little bit. Let's get into that. And now, man, we don't have enough time to get into all of it, but let's go 1991. That's kind of a year I was looking at some of your stats and thinking about questions I wanted to ask you. 91, your factory, you've won some Ultra Crosses, you and your brother Tyson. You get a factory Suzuki ride, and by all accounts, I remember you doing pretty well. I think you won at least a Supercross or two. Nationals, I think you were a decent rider. Talk about that 91 season a little bit, and because after that, you went to Europe.
That's right. No, actually, I think the best would be a quick rundown of, 90. That's where it all started.
Okay.
It was, my rookie year.
Yeah, yeah.
And if I would have done the same thing nowadays, I would be rich. But I came out my first race at Hangtown. I got third.
Yep.
Then the next race, Axon, fifth. And I almost won. I got second to Jean-Michel Bale. He passed me on the last lap at Mount Morris.
Yep.
So at that point, I was running third in the nation. And also at that point, the points were really different. So I was called a pro-am rider.
Right.
And because I was beating Emig and the rest of those guys, I was getting maximum pro-am points per week. So going into with about 3 rounds left, I was still third in the national championship, but I decided to take it easy and not ride the last few rounds because I just signed my factory Suzuki deal, and if I was continue to go and win these pro-am points, so be it I got fifth or
second, would you have been moved up?
Pointed out, yeah. So I had to be careful with the Supercross the way that it was.
Right.
It was really messed up in the past. So fortunately, I signed in 91.
Mm-hmm.
I came out. I got third in my first race. I won Houston, beating McGrath. And actually, Tyson was on the podium. He got second that day. So that was like one of my highlights of the career. That's why I had to mention that.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. that would have been an East-West race, right, if I remember right?
It was an East-West shootout at that time.
Right.
So, I ended up winning that. And then I was leading the championship, went into New York, and I dislocated my shoulder. So then I had to get surgery, sitting out most of the outdoor season. And that's really the time when they make decisions for factory rides. And, they went ahead and hired Lamson, and I was pretty much out. So, but I had a decent offer for some money, better money than I had here, to go to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother had already been there on that same team a few years earlier, so I went ahead and took it, thinking, being young and dumb, thinking, oh, man, the Europeans, who the hell are they? They have no visors, a black helmet, and 3 digits. So I'll just go there, win me a world title, and come back and have a factory ride.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
In the early 90s, when you lost your factory ride, you didn't never get an opportunity again. It was over.
Yep.
So you had that one chance. And so that's what I was talking about earlier. It was amazing that 10 years later, I come back, and I was getting this opportunity that at that time, if I dreamed about it, I would have woke up and said, that's not possible.
So yeah, yeah.
Life is stranger than dreams, and that's why you have to always push on no matter what your setbacks, because, 5 to 10 years later, you might be somewhere where you thought never possible.
Yeah, how strange is that, though? You have this great year, and so you hurt your shoulder, you miss a lot of the outdoors, but, I mean, good God, the year before, you were top 3 before pulling out, and just... You lose your ride? That just
yeah,
I guess there was no support teams back then either. There wasn't
that,
there was yeah.
That's exactly right. You have factory team, or you're in your van or your box van. Mm-hmm. I guess I could run through if you got a second a little bit more. So then my next big opportunity was signing on as the second rider to Stephen Everts on Jan De Groot in 96.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you right now, from a rider's perspective, how important it is to have a good team and a good bike.
Yeah.
I mean, immediately from running eighth in the world, having some sketchy results, sometimes good, sometimes bad, to leading the world championship for most of the season before injuring myself and Stefan getting the title that year. But
yeah.
It just amazed me. I was even surprised myself that, with the right bike and program.
Yeah.
I guess that's why Mitch ain't lucky, It's like the guys he gets in the right program, and somebody always wins on that team.
Well, especially in Europe, where there's so many sort of, I don't want to say shady, but there's just so many different teams getting different levels of help, and it's not a structured thing like it is over here. So, I mean,
right.
When you first went to Europe, how old were you?
I was 20.
20.
So
you head over there. Is Tyson with you at this point just to hang out? Or?
No, he wasn't.
Okay.
No, he was still here in the States doing some racing, and I went over there, and he actually joined me just before that season with Jan De Groot. So I guess there was another change,
okay.
But my brother came over and started helping me, which,
yeah.
I lost 3 years of my career just trying to adjust the European lifestyle and the languages, and
yeah.
It was so tough.
That's what I wanted
I think that's why guys like me and Brownie came back and were on fire that year, because you got such a chip on your shoulder for going over there. You're like, okay, I'm not going to lose this opportunity.
Yeah, what was that like when you headed over there? I mean, how did you – who did you sign with? Weren't you on a Pepsi Honda team or something?
No, that was in 94. The first
okay.
year was 92, and I actually went for the same team my brother rode a couple years earlier, which were just a couple Italian guys, importers of Suzuki of Italy.
Okay.
And their names were Carpi Motor.
Mm-hmm.
So it was decent. I did a couple years with them, had some injuries, bike failures, and so on,
yep.
And I moved over to the Pepsi Honda team, which people may not know this, but Roger DeCosta was our team
right.
manager there.
Right, yeah.
Pretty crazy.
Yeah, no. At first, did you think, hey, I got these guys covered, and then all of a sudden the GPs roll around in the mud and the sand, and you're like, oh, wait a minute? I mean,
it wasn't that they were that much better than me or anything. It became, when I first went over, I'd be Donnie Schmidt, I'd be a lot of the guys, I was killing them, but then the lifestyle every day,
yep.
You don't know nobody, you don't talk to nobody, you're just doing your training, you start getting burned out about 4 or 5 weeks in,
yep.
And then the GPs are tough, man. They're a lot, those guys had factory bikes, they were, I mean, they may not have visors, they may have black helmets, but they haul butt.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a little bit, I had to do some adjusting and get better, and it just the whole life thing. But finally getting the good opportunity in 96, I started really moving forward with my career in Europe and making some money.
Yeah.
And then I moved on to the Chesterfield, which was a cigarette sponsor at that time.
Yeah.
Chesterfield Rinaldi Yamaha team for a couple of years. And so that was also beneficial too. And then the end of that, that's when I came back to America in 99.
So the closest you came was the year that you with De Groot when you hurt your shoulder. The closest you came to winning
the title? I had two really good years. 96, I led till about 4 rounds from the end. I got hurt in Poland,
mm-hmm.
And then in 97, I came in strong. I won the Star Cross. I caught Pastorelli and Everts to win the first GP there in Spain. I was leading the championships after 5 rounds going into Italy, and then it was kind of like my life story, leading the championships for many years. Even in Supercross, when I rode
yeah.
the post circuit, the second year I was leading the Supercross championship and crashed and broke my shoulder again. So after so many years of that, I finally decided, hey, you know what, if I was going to win it, I would have won it. There's something holding me back, and it ain't me. It's just something mental. So
yeah.
That's what happened.
Did you, when you raced in Europe all those years, how often did you get back to the States, or did you embrace it, and that was it? You were there. Like, I know Brownie went. Go ahead.
In 93 and 4, I was just, man, I was crying sometimes. So then I thought, well, I'll fly back to America because I feel so good once I'm at home, and I'll just take a flight over there. Well, the jet lag was killing me, so I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
I finally came to a conclusion. I kept my place in Italy, and I also had a house rented in Belgium. So I had two different places, and when I got bored or burned out, let's say, training in Belgium,
mm-hmm.
I'd run down to Italy and live there for a month. So I would fly between the two places, and my brother would drive my van, and that's how I managed to try to stay fresh but change my environment a little bit.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Did you live in Belgium with everybody else, Everts and all the dudes?
Yeah,
yeah,
I mean, it was really cool. We lived in a place called Ballin. It was actually Eric Gabor's brother rented me a little apartment, and I was just—it's funny, but I lived right by Josh Coppin, so I know him pretty well when he first came over and started his career.
Oh, that's
and
funny.
We lived in the same place called Ballin, but within a 10-mile square area, we probably had 5 tracks. I'd just get up, put my gear on, we'd throw the bike in the back, go ride in the morning, come back, you know, eat some lunch and stuff, then we'll go out to another track that would open in the afternoon, so we'd be able to hit two tracks a day.
Nice, yeah, so that's kind of like around Lomel and all that area?
Lomel, I could hear the bikes riding. I lived right by
Lomel.
Oh,
no way, really? When I worked for Ferry at the Diz Nations, we practiced at Lomel for that weekend, so it was cool for me to be there. I'm glad to have said that I've set foot on the legendary Lomel circuit, so.
Yeah, Lomel, and then I don't know if you've been to Honda Park, but that's like 2 miles away from Lomel, and then there's a couple other tracks, Detzel and some other older tracks that Joel Smith set me up with. So.
Oh, yeah.
And they're all like Lomel, let me tell you. So it's gnarly training there in Belgium. That's why everybody goes there. It's kind of like Florida. It's just gnarly sand training. It pounds you.
Yeah, yeah. And then where did you live in Italy? Like what area?
Mostly around Bologna.
Okay.
I mean, I call my city Bologna, but I first originally started in Reggio Emilia, which is a little north, and then I lived in Parma when I rode for Rinaldi, but I always kept an apartment in Bologna.
Oh, okay. All right.
That's like Sacramento for me.
Yeah, really, I guess, huh? And then so really you really kind of embraced Europe, I'm guessing. You didn't do the whole back and forth thing all the time. You just were like, screw it, I'm here. It's Belgium or Italy.
Yeah.
That's it.
After 2 years, I got my system down, and then, like you said, I embraced it. Well, I figured, okay, if I didn't come back and get that factory ride the next year, the year after that, my career was done. I got to finish it here in Europe, so I started just trying to win titles over there.
Right, right, right.
And, and became very close, but still, you know. And it's funny, as you get older now, I look back, I was kind of like, I wasn't liking it that much living over there, but now it's like, man, you're awesome. So it's always greener on the other side, you know?
Yeah, I was going to ask you, after, you know, you grew up an American, you lived there for so long, and now you're back in America, what do you like about Europe? What do you like better than America? Like, just after years of thinking about it, what do they got going on over there?
If I just talk about in general,
yeah, just in general,
you know, it feels like you live back in time, like 30 years ago, like when my grandma was a kid or something. Just the way the people are, things are more laid back. Seems like people a little bit more honest, you know. And I don't know, it's a nice feeling, you know. Food is more, particularly in Italy, food is more important. Everybody sits down and eats, so it's just a lot slower pace, and it's just a nice change. You know, I live here in California, so it's, I mean, you come out here, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, it's just go, go, go all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of times people are your buddy, and the next thing you know, they're trying to date your girlfriend or wife. You got to be terrible.
Yeah, exactly. Who was your closest friends in all those years with GPs, rider-wise?
You know, it's much different over there. I mean, it's not like you have a real friend per se, but, you know, even Stefan, Pete Beyer, those guys, we would fly to, you know, Brazil, or we'd fly to Japan or whatever. Everybody just hangs out. It was a lot more like your business was done on the track and that was it, where you see here and it's just so intense and so competitive. When off track, the guys are like staring each other down and shit, and you're like, man, it's gnarly. It wasn't like that over there. Like, you could be buddies right before you go out and just battle them, you know?
Yeah.
So it was definitely different. So I wouldn't say I had like a really good friend, but, you know, it was friendly enough with all the guys.
It's that time. Time for a commercial. Sorry, guys. Got to pay the bills.
Thanks for listening to the BTOsports.com podcast show. Please don't forget that BTO is the world leader in aftermarket motocross parts for the bike or body. You'll find deals like a Shoei VFXW helmet for $309.99, 45% off, or Smith Piston goggles for $32.99, 65% off. Your order can be shipped to anywhere in the USA for free. Or if you're not in the USA, we ship worldwide. Check it out at btosports.com.
It was weird because I went to the Teuschenthal GP this past summer, and I was eating in Martin Honda pit, and here comes Coppins. He ate dinner at the Martin Honda pit, and one of the Rinaldi mechanics came over and he ate in there. It was just no big, I mean, like, let's see Reedy go over to the L&M team, sit down and grab a hot dog. You know what I mean? Like, it was, when I walked around, it just struck me. Everybody, the DV was hanging out in some different pits. You know what I mean? I get what you mean. It's really different over there. It's way more casual.
Yeah, it's totally, like I said, even going to the line, guys will be talking and stuff. Now, you're getting ready to go battle that guy for the title, but it's not that intense.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like here, it's totally different. It's intense off the track as well as on the track.
You had to have an old-time racer like yourself, and I think almost any old-time racer had to just laugh his ass off at the Reed-Stewart controversy this weekend. Like, you know, Reed braked early and Stewart fell into him. Ooh, big deal. And it just, you know, was the biggest deal. And you guys like you were like, that's it? That's all he did?
it didn't seem like much. And then I heard there was a lot of things going on in the pit area after that.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't, I don't know, but you know, it's just there is a lot of money in the prestige of winning those Supercrosses. It's for me bigger than even the World GPs. I mean, yeah. Supercross is the number one, and there is a lot of money and pressure on those guys. So, but, I mean, they probably just both overreacted to whatever the situation was.
Yeah, at the same time, I'm sure that you got into some gnarly battles on the track, and that's where it stayed, right? I mean, I'm not judging either guy here. I'm just saying that,
right?
You know, an old school guy like yourself, you're just going, come on, guys, calm down.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, I didn't know exactly what went on in the pit area, but, I raced in Europe, so it was more like laid back like that. Yeah. Oh, good job, man. Yeah, it's all good. I catch you in the next corner. Okay.
Yeah. I T-bone you coming up.
I could tell you some stories, but go ahead.
Oh, I bet. What are you going to, so 98, you're in Europe. How does the ride from FMF materialize? Were you looking, I think Bobby Moore was your agent maybe.
He'd been there and he actually lived right next to the apartment.
Right.
To me in 97 and riding the 125s, I was riding the 250 at that time, which were two strokes. And, he'd come over to America and run the FMF team in 98 when I was still in Europe. So then he came back and called me. He's like, Town, you know, these are good deals over here, and there's like huge bonus money.
Yeah.
And at that time, it was like $25,000 to win a Supercross, and
right.
$20,000 to win the outdoor per race.
Right.
Well, in Europe, I'd get like $3,000 on the factory deal to win a GP. You know, so
yeah.
I was like, no, you can't. I go, bring me the numbers. So he sent me over a real offer from Honda with those bonuses. I'm like, okay, I have one obligation. I want the full factory suspension that Lanson had or some full, because I knew at that point in my career how important suspension was.
Mm-hmm.
And they agreed to it. And so I said, shoot, I'm going. I mean, the compensation was pretty good, but the bonuses are astronomical compared to what I'd been getting. You know?
So
that's what I did.
Wow. So, so really you just jumped at it, huh? I mean, you were pumped. They were happy. You were happy. Everything was good.
I said to my brother, look, if we're ever going to go back to America, this is it. We got to just make the change. And so that's what we decided to do.
Yeah. So talk about that 99 season for you, how it went. I know we'll just talk about the 99 season, and then I'll ask my next question.
Well, I'll tell you a pretty fast, crazy story about that season. I don't know if you remember, we were struggling with the bikes a little bit that year.
I do.
You know, Chris Gosler still has a limp from that. The bikes were bogging and popping the ignitions off.
You may not know this, but I worked there in 98 in FMF Honda for Danny Smith. So I realized we had a lot of bike problems. Our bike was not that fast.
Yeah, they were just, you know, trying to get in, and we had some, I don't want to mention names, but people working on, they just weren't working right.
Right.
Okay, so that point in Supercross where I was coming up short on triples and bogging and popping, and I was getting injured, and I finally went to Daytona. I switched over to the East Coast, went to Daytona, and at Daytona I pulled off halfway through the race. I was struggling. I'd hurt my shoulder a little bit, and I talked to my brother and said, look, this is it. I'm done.
Yeah.
You know, I quit. And he's like, yeah, we've had a great career. You know, it's like, I can't deal with this crash and this bike anymore.
Yeah.
And I came home, and I sat down for about a week, and I decided, you know, I think I can beat these guys. That's what I told my brother, and he's like, well, then let's do it.
Right.
And I'm like, let's just focus on the outdoor. So I go, okay, I called over to, nobody knows this, but I called over to SRS, which is guys who were sponsoring Just a Minute at the time. I know they built Hondas.
Yep.
I called them. I said, look, I want to fly over there. This is on my own money.
Oh,
try your bike. If it's good, I'll buy the engine.
I know this story.
Do you remember that?
That was my next question. I know this story.
Okay, yeah. So I actually flew over there,
tested
the bike. It wasn't as fast as my bike, but I knew I had factory suspension. It was a good running bike, never popped, never bogged. And then, you know, long story short, I come back. People had already heard about it, that I was there. They offered to let me just go ahead and use that engine as long as I continue to use my FMF pipes and all that. And I said, yeah, that's great. And so at that point on, for the next 6 weeks, I just trained like harder than I've ever trained before, and that's where people see me at Glen Helen. Glen Helen and Hangtown, I end up, you know, racing a passing Ricky, and I beat him the first month at Hangtown. And for the time, even people may not even realize this, but even after 8 races at Unadilla where I finally crashed and took myself out, I was only 14 points behind after 8 races.
Yeah, no,
Ricky.
No, absolutely. No, you were, like I said in the intro, you're one of the last guys to really take it to him sometimes. My question was, how did that go over with FMF guys and Honda guys, you bringing your motor over? How was that?
It was actually okay because they were struggling with the build that we were using, and And they said, okay, look, it's just a cylinder head and piston. It's not that big of a deal. And so if you want to use that and you feel comfortable, we need to get results. I mean, we just have to use the FMF pipe. So we worked around that engine with Donnie, and it was good. And it was, and we worked from there. And once I had the setting, then I just pretty much trained. The rest of it was just training.
Yeah, really. And then I guess, too, when you're backing it up with results, what can they say, right, when you're out there?
Right.
Exactly. So when you came back, I mean, what were the – obviously, RC is RC. He was amazing, but you were running with him. Were you surprised? I mean, did you know you had the speed to do that?
I honestly thought that I did. I was so trained. When you train that hard, I mean, I was training two times a day like I normally do, plus I was sprinting up these hills, weights on my back.
Yeah, like what are we talking, bicycling, weights, sprinting up hills?
Strap these weights on my back, and I'd run up this really steep hill. We practice this place called Mammoth Bar, and it's like a 8% grade going down into this. So after I do my 2 30- to 40-minute motos, then I'd sprint up that hill. What I'd do with my hard motor, I'd do 1 minute up, and then I'd come back down a little bit, and 1 minute up, so I was doing these 8 sprints.
Yeah.
Then I'd run on all the way off, the weights off, just up to the end of the road, and then jump in the van. My dad would take me home. I'd sleep. He'd prepare the bike, and then we'd go back out and try to hit one more moto in the evening. And I'd do that 1 to 2 days on, then a day off. Then, when I recovered, then 2 days on, 1 day off.
Wow. And that was your life for a few months there before Glen Helen.
Yeah, I was living with my grandma. So when I came back, I kept the renters in my house. I just stayed focused. And because I actually came back and rented a house down in L.A., but then I decided it was tough to live away from home, so I just moved in with my grandma and started training like that. I was just 100. So when I went to that gate, I was really confident. I didn't care who was on the line.
Dude,
went over. Ricky won the first moto, and I told my dad, I just got to get off the gate because I went down that first moto.
Yeah.
And I go, I'll I think I can win. And I don't know if you guys ever watched on a video, but I came from like 10 seconds back to catch and pass him.
Yeah. No. It was a great ride. Dude, it kind of reminds me of like Rocky going back to the roots. You know what I mean?
It was cool, dude, because it was an awesome event for me because nobody knew the hell I was because I pretty much took the Supercross off. I was getting no results, and everybody's like, who the hell is this 7-Eleven guy?
Yeah. And you won the Buds Creek Mudder, right? I think.
Right. Well, that's why I gained all my points. I was so dumb, I didn't realize how fast Ricky was in the sand, right? So I'm like, me and my brother, we're working. We always worked really close together, and we would, he ran my pit board so we could run our strategies and everything. I said, okay, look, we'll get him at Southwick, so let's just stay close, and at Southwick, I'll kill him.
Yeah.
Wow. And he killed me. He killed me so bad that it was ridiculous.
But then also,
I didn't know I was thinking because I've been training in Belgium, and for the years in the sand that I just waxed him there. But man, it was a wake-up call, let me tell you.
Well, also, too, Southwick isn't exactly the pure Euro sand track either.
I totally miscalculated. I was going to say that, but people probably don't understand. The sand in Europe is like beach sand. It's endless sand, so you get these huge sand whoops, and you're just going, where that's like kind of choppy little small sand bumps, really hard bumps you're going across.
Yeah, when DeRiver came over a couple of years ago, I mean, I was telling, I don't know who I was telling, maybe Coppins or what. I'm like, dude, Southwick isn't like what he's used to. Sure, DeRiver may be a good sand rider, but this isn't really sand, But
right, that's right. Well, DeRiver and the extreme sand is probably the best in the world I've seen. That guy's amazing.
Yeah.
People probably don't know who he is, but I raced against him in Lomo, and the guy was just unbelievable fast.
I saw something on TV at Vulcan Swad where he was gone. He was you were not catching him on that day. It was a couple of years ago. Amazing.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So FMF Honda days come to an end, and you get, were you thinking about retiring? Did Mitch make you an offer to go to the PC team? How did that offer come about?
Well, most of 99 was perceived as being successful because a lot of the decisions are made during the Nationals, which in this year, 99 compared to 91, worked to my benefit.
Right.
So Mitch actually, what I'd heard, Mitch actually asked Ricky, like, hey, I mean, who the heck should I hire you next year? And Ricky's like, I'd hire Talon. That guy's old, but he hauls ass.
Right.
So that's how it came about. And so then Mitch called me, and we went down there and ended up doing a 2-year deal. So it was, it took a little while, but we got it done. It was good.
What did you think of the of riding for Mitch after all these years, the team and the bikes and all that? I mean, you had been pretty happy.
Yeah, everything was good. I liked Mitch. I feel like I had one misfortune. They had a new guy change in Kawasaki when I look back on it, and I really struggled with the suspension. I had a factory suspension deal, but me and Larry Ward and John Dowd had to run this new developed suspension, which for me was a step backwards, and we were struggling trying to work it, where Ricky was also on the team on the 250, he was still able to use his old stuff or any stuff that he wanted.
Uh-huh.
And so we were like, oh, no, we just got to keep working with you guys. We'll get it better. And that kind of bummed me out, you know. And then
right.
finally I ended up just telling Mitch, look, I don't want to run that stuff. I'll run yours. And that's when he started with the show with stuff. He started with the show with stuff, and then we really started working. And from that year on, from 2000, that's why they still run the show with stuff now.
Yeah, yeah. So, but there had to have been some teething problems there too, I imagine, in the beginning, right? Or was
yeah, but it was better. It was better than what I had from KHI at that time.
Oh, it
time.
Was.
So
really?
I went ahead and went with it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. And
because the stuff before the air, the gas, they had those upside down gas ones.
Yep.
And that's what Ricky was allowed to run, and that's what I was supposed to have. And then they changed it. And I said, no, we have to continue to develop this one.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know. I just sometimes it's always politics, you know. Unless you're above a certain Ricky, you don't have to deal with too much politics. You can call the shots. It's difficult.
Yeah. When you're Talon Volan, though, you get the old stuff, or you get the crap.
Well,
stuff.
It just depends. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it just depends. But yeah, I wasn't Ricky. That's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And at the end of the 2 years, did you know you were done? That was it.
Well, yeah, I had a pretty bad head injury at the end of the second year. So I had like something
oh,
like Brock
you?
Kepler had now. Yeah, I had a second grade concussion. You know, I've had concussions in the past. It takes 6-7 days. You feel pretty good. You can ride. You come to realize when you heal up better that really you're still not 100%.
Uh-huh.
But you're decent, okay? But when I got that second grade concussion, it took me 2 months before I could actually ride. I got like vertigo on the bike. I couldn't ride.
Wow.
So at that point, I pretty much, again, set out most of the outdoor season, and then it worked against me. I had another opportunity for decent money to go back to Europe. But when you get to that point in your career where you're, you know, you're looking more like, hey, I still want to make the good money, but a lesser team has to pay you that money to go with them,
yeah,
you still
yeah.
think, hey, I can still do it. You know, I can still mm-hmm. get those results even with this kind of team. And then you get into the season and you realize, you know what, you're getting older, you're realizing, I seen these younger guys. When I knew my career was over, I saw Ben Townley coming to the line, and he was wearing his glasses and just being kind of cocky. You know, he had like first or second pick, I had like 13th pick on the gate.
Uh-huh.
And I realized at that moment when I was thinking, God, he looks just like how I used to feel. And as soon as I said that to myself, I said, Jesus, I'm done.
okay.
You know?
Wait a minute here.
Everybody says you have that moment, and
yeah,
that
yeah.
was the moment for me that I realized, you know what? The problem is you get in your career where you've had factory stuff, you've had the best parts,
mm-hmm.
then you get on the backside where you're not having as good of stuff, and you're not ignorant anymore. You know what they got.
Yeah.
Plus they're young, aggressive, and, yeah, it's just an uphill battle, and it's hard to fight that battle forever.
Okay, wait a minute. You went back to Europe after PC?
Yeah, my last year was 2000.
Oh,
and
shit. My memory's failing me because I do not remember that. Yeah. Huh.
Yeah, a lot of people, I was glad, though. Don't mind you. It was not a good result.
What team was it? What kind of bike was it? I don't even remember.
It was Kawasaki, and it was MJ Church out of England.
England, yeah, yeah. Really?
Yeah, so,
I do not
Yeah, it was
that.
Kind of good. I had my old mechanic that he had moved over there from Yonder Group, so that's how the deal came together. And mm-hmm. it was still kind of a Team Green team that wasn't the official Cowie team. At that time, it was Mikhail Machio.
Right.
So he ended up winning the title that year.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was actually the first year they really developed a whole new Kawasaki. So I was still riding that one that was like 6 years old, but he had this whole brand new bike that came out, you know, and it
yeah,
was
yeah.
very difficult. And at that time, the KTMs were so dominant. I mean, there must have been 20 KTMs on the line. It was ridiculous.
Okay. Huh. Some host I am, because I don't remember that. I thought you retired at PC. But then I also seem to remember you riding some nationals that second year, but maybe not. I don't know. You hit your head.
I did do a few towards the end. But
yeah, okay,
maybe
that's it then, yeah.
Yep.
So looking back, I mean, no major titles, but are you happy? You're happy with your career?
Yeah, you know, I have to bring up one thing that I have that I think me and Langston, you know, obviously he's win titled, but
yeah.
I won a Nash, a 250 GP, I've won a 125 GP, I've won a 125 National, I've won both East and West Coast Supercrosses. So I'm one of the only riders
yeah.
that ever done that.
You're just missing a 250 Nash, 250 and 500 GP.
Yeah, that's right. No, I won a 250 GP, not a 500, but I didn't win a 250
yeah,
National.
Yeah, 250 National. You're missing a 250 National right. and a 500 GP. Did you ever
right.
think about jump? Well, by the time you were in Europe, the 500 class was kind of a shadow of its former self, huh? Like, did you?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, that's right. It was pretty much dead. I had Joel out there winning the title.
Yeah.
I never really thought much about that.
Right,
but,
right.
You know, I'm super happy with my career. I'm glad to get out because, you know, it's easy also to get injured in this. It's a pretty high-risk sport.
Yeah.
And I've made a lot of good friends. I've learned a lot. You know, what you you know, in life, what you think sometimes is a negative for you can sometimes turn out to be a positive over time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, going to Europe and learning to speak Italian and learning that mentality has benefited me and business and personally. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah,
you know, I look back on it. I mean, obviously, you always wish you could make more money, yeah. But no matter how much money you have, you're always going to wish that. So I'm happy with where I'm at. I have a great family, a good house, and I have a great job working in the industry. So
yeah.
I'm pretty happy with the way everything has went so far.
Yeah, if you would have asked the kid racing ultracrosses in Cleveland or wherever the hell it was, 20 years from now, this is what's going to happen. I think you would have took it, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, you know, I remember even in 91, 92, and you don't have much money, and you're like, man, how am I going to get there, you know? But
yeah.
If you just keep working hard and persevering, you get there.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Don't give up. There's a lot of kids out there sometimes that are struggling, but if they're listening, like, don't give up, because like I said, if you keep going, you never know the next year what can fall into your favor.
Now, getting back to talking about that a little bit, does going to the amateur nationals and seeing the sort of the go for broke homeschooled mentality kind of bum you out at all? I mean, does it is it just amazing to you? What are your thoughts when you go to like a Loretta Lynn's nowadays?
Well, what amazes me off the bat is these kids like doing this Bubba Scrub thing. I'm like, what the? It's unbelievable. Like every kid does that nowadays. I'm like,
yeah.
Oh my god, my. Because I'd be honest, my son's already riding, so here I go again. But
yeah, yeah.
his 2010 Cobra arrives tomorrow.
Oh, geez.
That's how bad I am.
Oh, okay.
Want to do it over again?
Never mind. Then you are one of those dads. Never mind that question. Then.
Well, the thing is about our sport that I think is different than other sports is, you almost your peak of your career becomes between 17 and 25.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, it's not very old when you look at, you know, everything in the world, but yeah. In our sport, it's, you know, you're getting up there, you're already getting old, so the kids got to be fast by that time.
Right.
I don't know how these kind of new rules that are getting implemented are going
right.
to affect things.
If some kid came to you, 21 years old, 22 years old, I'm trying to think of somebody in particular in mind, sort of a kid like a Matt Lemoyne or something like that, sort of on the outside of making it, would you recommend going to Europe? I mean, would you tell
well,
somebody that?
I'll tell you, things have really changed from the time I was there. When Lungo first started to run it was good. You know, when you qualify for GP, which I'd qualify for everyone, you would
yeah.
get 900 Swiss francs. So I was making like 1,200 bucks before I even stepped on the gate, and then I would win another eight. So I was making about $2,000 a week
yeah.
when I was racing. So I would live off of that because at 15 races, I'd make about 30,000 and send all my compensation home.
Right.
Now, the way Lungo has it set up, there's no win money. You only get what you negotiate in your contract. And
right.
a guy like that, he's probably going to have to suffer a little bit his first year over there.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I could recommend that. I mean, it's a tough thing. Now, if you're a young kid like this kid coming out of Germany now or something like that really
Roxen,
fast here.
Roxen or...
Yeah, like yeah. a Roxen or let's just say like a Barsha or something like that.
Yeah.
Could potentially go over there for a couple years and race the world championship and get a... Like, I look at Roxen bike, it's full factory.
Yeah.
I know how important and how big of a difference that makes.
Right.
So if you were like Barsha went over there with Honda and did the World GPs for 2 years on a full factory bike, then you come over here at 20 years old or 18 when you can race the Nationals, you're going to be ready.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you might see a Scene Cirillo or whatever do that, huh? Maybe.
My son, if I'm going in that direction, that's what I'm going to do because I see you can get over there and get a full factory bike like Rookson at 15 or 16 if you're really good.
Mm-hmm.
I plan to do some training over there with him, and then if we can pull that, by the time he's 17, he'll have full factory bikes. He'll be in the testing mode and how it works, and then he'll be ready to come back when he's 18 to go into the Nationals.
Right, right, right. Yeah. No, what struck me as funny when I was over there at the GP and talking to the media guys and the team managers, everybody wants to come to America. Either they're planning on it, they're working on it, they have, you know, so everybody wants to come to America. Musquin, Roxen,
right. Right.
You name it, you know.
Right. Well, there's, I'll tell you, the reason is there's just no money over there.
Right.
I mean, you might get Roxen, he's going to get some from Red Bull and his outside sponsors,
yeah.
and it's decent, but really, you know, with the bonuses and the money that is here in this market in America, it's just you can't beat it. You have to be here, and it's worse than ever.
Yeah.
At least you could make a living when I was over there. Now you can't even make a living.
Hey, $40,000 for goggles, that's more than probably a lot of those dudes make a year.
That is absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely right. I mean, you got to be the number one guy. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah,
we're talking guys like Bubba Stewart, Chad Reed, and
right.
these kind of guys. But, you know, you got to be here because this is where the bonuses are and this
yeah.
is where the money is.
So I take it you're not a big fan of the GPs these days in the way that they're going about it.
No, I'm really not. I saw Joel Smith quit, and I'm really, to be honest, I guess I shouldn't be shouting, but I don't know why some of the teams even participate.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it's fair. I'm on the other side where I negotiate again, you know, for riders and things, but
yeah.
I'm also a rider at heart, and you know, I know that we are, any rider goes out there, he risks his life every
yeah.
single day.
Right.
And just to go out, I mean, that's almost like college football. Those guys out there play all day and then they don't get one dime. Like, how the hell do you go risk your life and not get paid to do it?
Yeah, as cheeseball as it sounds, it really is. They're risking their life. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
You're not over-dramatizing it by saying that. What does your guys at Cherubi say? The Italians, I mean, is it a general consensus over there a little bit that what's going on with the GPs? What's happened to the mighty GPs? I mean.
Well, it just seems like until somebody stands up or somebody creates an organization together to stand up, most of the people, the whisper is, hey, we don't like it. Hey, this isn't right.
Right.
But, you know, everybody wants to keep their job and keep going to the races because a lot of people's jobs are based off going to the races,
yeah.
that they don't really cry or scream too loud. Who needs to make the stand-ups are the major team managers of the factory teams, be it, you know, Ronaldo Yamaha or I don't know who's running Kawasaki now. I don't think it's John DeGroote or, you know, these major teams need to get together one day and go, look, either we're starting our own little league in Belgium or, we're just not going to go to the World GPs until at least our athletes get paid.
Right. Yeah, no, I'm with you.
It's
a strange deal. One of the Honda guys, one of the high ups at Honda explained it to me when I was over there. And, you know, it really sounds like a lot of the tracks and a lot of the teams got taken for a little bit of a ride from the initial promises when it first came in.
I've actually heard, and I don't know, I can't confirm this, but I actually heard this year that they're actually making each team pay an entry fee. Every race has an entry fee. So for their athletes that come, they have to pay entry fee for them.
Yeah, I think you're right.
When I raced GPs, there was no entry fee.
Yeah.
It was just you had to pay. I had to pay the AMA for my license a certain amount to be
right.
involved in the World GPs, but there was no entry fee. And then if I qualified, which that was pretty easy for me,
yeah.
I would make 900 Swiss francs every race. Every rider that qualified on the line got that. It was like the standard.
Right. And then, of course, you raked it in the preseason races for show-up money.
It's funny, but, you know, okay, of course, guys make so much money, but in the old days, in the 90s and even late 80s, man, you get huge show-up money for just these.
Yeah.
I would race just little Italian supercrosses, and I might get like $3,000 to show up. It was crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Before I let you go, what's your greatest race you ever had?
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, I really reflect on the one where it was the coolest thing when me and Tyson were running first and second at an East-West shootout, and then Tyson McGrath got by him just at the end. But it was that had to be one of the highlights. I mean, I have a few of them there in 97 when I passed those guys, you know, Everett and Tortelli to win that GP, so that stands out. But, you know, those are probably the best. I mean, also, 99 was great. I just wish I wouldn't have tipped over at Glen Helen.
Yeah, exactly. No, you can't say but in the list. It's got to be the greatest one.
So I'll just say that when I look back on my career, I didn't win titles because of, you know, crashing or whatever, but mm-hmm. at least on some particular days, I was probably the fastest man in the world. So I can look at myself
right.
and say that, be confident that I'm right about that.
That's pretty cool to say because not too many can. So
Right, exactly. So that's what I mean, I know Langston's won titles and so on, but, like, just for certain days, I was the fastest man to step on a bike. That's what I got, and that's what I'm taking.
I was going to tell you, too, Giuseppe's coming to A2, so maybe you can brush up all your Italian and talk to him a little bit.
Oh, I actually heard that, yeah.
Yeah. He'll probably be.
He doesn't owe me any money, so I'm fine.
He'll probably be in the Scott bus at some point. Everybody is.
Yeah, that's right. Our bus is, you know, it's always been at every event every year, and we have Bevo continues to do our hospitality for me. And,
yeah.
I mean, you know, everybody's welcome to stop by and say hi.
I don't go in there. I'm scared of that place.
Why?
It's just there's too many heavy hitters in there. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm just some putz, ex-mechanic journalist. And when I go in there, there's always, like, the who's who of moto, and I feel like I don't belong in here. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, our Scott big rig, we call it Switzerland. So everybody can come in. We'll even have the top two distributors, be it Western and
right.
Arch or Tucker. The boss is actually sitting in there eating burgers, talking. So
right.
nobody's allowed to really battle in there. You just come in, eat, you know, enjoy some of the old school talk that Bevo brings along, and
right.
you know, it's good for everybody.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm still scared of it, Lone Wolf. So I wouldn't look for me in there. But And then, of course, John Knowles always in there building goggles, working away. There is nobody in this business as serious about goggles as John Knowles. Nobody.
That's right, and I'm so glad that I have him to work with now. He's been there 6 years. You know, he built the goggles for Reed, Stroop, Millsap, all the Pro Circuit team, every single week. These guys, like, you got to see him build some goggles. It takes him, like, 5 seconds.
I know, and he's out there with his BlackBerry, like, looking at the weather reports when it's perfectly sunny outside, but he's just checking, you know, just to make sure. You know what I mean? Like,
Boy, I tell you, he rang my phone every morning about the weather. He gets crazy about the weather. So he had to build so many roll-offs prepared just for this weekend, you know.
Right.
It's insane.
No,
he's the best guy out there, though, I'll tell you. So, he's a benefit for me in negotiating with my riders because most of the riders know him. He's been around so long that you know, they know they're going to get the best service with Scott.
Although I was at Yamaha working for Ferry when Reed chucked a pair of goggles at him. That was awesome.
He probably just wanted to rebuild them for the second moto. That's all.
We love reminiscing about that story. But Talon, thank you for doing the show, man. Always a guy I've wanted to get on for a long time and to talk about what a great career you've had. Everywhere, you know, what a worldly sort of career you've had, and now like I said, you've got a great job in the industry as well. So real neat perspective. You can see it from a GP rider's side, an American rider's side, a top executive in a company side. You know what I mean? Like, you've really got a great perspective on everything, I think. Anyways,
right, I appreciate that. Like I said, you know, just for all the younger kids that are listening, or people that are struggling or have had a bad race, because it always seems like you're just as good as your last race.
Yeah.
You just got to continue on, because every year can be a new year with new opportunities, new sponsors, and things. Like I said, it was amazing that 10 years later I come back to America and race as fast as I did with Ricky Carmichael and the elite riders in the world. I never could have dreamed that. So
Just
keep that's it. Just keep pushing on.
Cool. Well, right on, man. Well, thank you, and then I will see you this weekend.
All right, Steve. Thanks. We'll see you there.
All right. See you, Ben.
Thanks. Bye.
This has been the BTOsports.com podcast show, brought to you by Trans World Motocross. Don't forget to check out some of our past shows, including motocross legends such as
The Beast from the East, Damon Bradshaw.
It got to the point to where I didn't want to leave home, and once I got to the race, I wasn't into it. If I wasn't going to give 100%, I'm not going to take their money.
The working class hero, Doug Henry.
It was definitely an emotional moment for me, just thinking to myself, that's it, you know, and it's amazing the stuff that goes through your head in a short amount of time of the things that, you know, that I was going to miss.
The Dogger, Ron Machine.
Until you really open your ears and you want to listen to what they're saying, it's like beating a dead horse. I mean, you know, and I know from personal experience, did anybody ever sit me down? Of course, everybody did.
Pro Circuits, Mitch Payton.
There's two ways to make the money. One is you can sign for money, or two, you can earn the money. I'm a high believer in earning the money. I think they ride better when they earn the money.
Seven-time Jeremy McGrath.
I was so mad, like so disappointed and so frustrated that I pulled pits and I left. Every point counts. I could kick myself to this day for not just riding around in tents. It's been no problem. My ego got in the way, you know?
The O Show, Johnny O'Mara.
Stuff that you'd sit there if you didn't even want to ride it, you just wanted to just look at it all day. I mean, I got a chance to test all that. I like that era I was in. I really do.
Search Mathis on the iTunes Store to find these and many more great podcasts. I won't let this die. You know I've got this bad up in the atmosphere. Another